Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots Monday Morning, where we watch the Sunday morning shows so that you don't have to. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Aaron Mate. Good Monday morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. As always, our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, get bonus content. And yeah, we have another great episode of Monday Morning for you. So much to mourn.
So much to mourn. And of course, make sure that you give this show a thumbs up, give it a like, and spread the word, tweet it out, FaceTime it out, and subscribe if you don't already subscribe.
Tell your neighbor.
This is live, not pre-recorded. Yeah, tell your neighbor. Tell your loved one. Tell your enemies, because they deserve it.
Bring back the tradition of banging on pots and clapping at 6 p.m. for COVID workers, but just do it for Useful Idiots at 10 a.m. on a Monday morning, Eastern time. You know, shout it out your window.
Totally agree. There we go. All right, now we're going to skip Meet the Press, right? Because it was so boring and just about Trump.
The recap, yes, we are. Yes.
Yeah. So yes. That's why, in case we should have made sure you were sitting down when we told you that, but we're skipping Meet the Press this week. And we're jumping right into Mitch McConnell. We're skipping the Meet the Press recap. We're jumping right into Meet the Press interview with Mitch McConnell.
Hear the deal in the Senate after this week with Ukrainian President Zelensky. Well, what was your message to President Zelensky? And is this aid getting there too late to make a difference, Leader McConnell?
So we've just authorized another $61 billion for the proxy war. And the question is not, hey, should we be spending another $61 billion in taxpayer money on a disastrous proxy war that has gone horribly and has killed tens of thousands of people? The question is, has the money gotten there too late?
Right.
That's the question.
Did we fail?
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we have sent it?
Should we have sent this tens of billions of dollars to the military industrial complex 6 months earlier rather than now? Not should we maybe spend that money, I don't know, to end homelessness in the United States? How about that? With a fraction of the money we're spending on the Ukraine proxy war. No.
Right. Or maybe should we prioritize ending the war?
Yes. No. Heaven forbid. Yeah. Heaven forbid. Okay. Let's hear Mitch McConnell's exciting response.
I can only express my own view, which is that I'm with them. And I don't think we ought to try to force a settlement they don't want to make. I have the same view of Israel, for example, you know, the administration basically saying you ought to have an election. It's not our job to tell them, Democratic ally, whether or not to have an election. Or also, and I think we've done some of this in both these countries, trying to give them restrictions on how they fight the war.
We should not do that. How dare we try to infringe upon Israel's right to wage genocidal war? They're a sovereign nation, and they should be allowed to, with our money and support, violate international law.
Well, great news for Mitch. Great news for Mitch. I mean, that's exactly what Biden is doing, contrary to what Republicans like to say, that Biden is somehow constrained Israel. He's given them carte blanche. It's recently emerged in the last few days that Anthony Blinken's been given all these direct warnings that, like, from his own staff, saying that that Israel's not following international humanitarian law by deliberately blocking aid, and that this should trigger an automatic suspension of U.S. aid. He also was apparently going to sanction some settler units or some Israeli military units in the West Bank. But even there, even though he said he would do that before, he's not even doing that. So.
And there were some settlers in the West Bank who were sanctioned, and then Biden removed that sanction.
So Mitch McConnell's criticism is very misplaced.
Yeah.
Biden's doing everything he wants and more.
But it's the principle that we admire, regardless of what Biden's doing, which is that Israel should have unfettered free reign to commit genocide.
They're there. They're in the conflict. I don't think telling them how they ought to run their military operation is in our best interest or theirs.
I want to get to the isolationism in your party, and I do want to get to the Middle East. But just on this.
By the way, how is it not in our best interest? I mean, I like the fact that he's reminding the world that politicians view the best interests of Israel and the United States as totally connected. But I'm just curious how that doesn't have that would harm our interests to have a less genocidal war.
Yeah, that would be a great follow-up question for any journalist who's just not automatically on board with bipartisan, you know, hegemonic consensus of just that we have the right to dominate the world and arm our proxies to the teeth and let them commit mass slaughter in the case of Israel. But you just can't ask that question because everyone assumes that, yeah, it is in our interest to be a hegemon and to commit mass murder. It's that's taken for granted.
Point. Do you think after this 6 months battle for aid to Ukraine, do you worry it's getting there too late?
I think we need to stick with them. I think
so. Really important to ask the question twice.
Yeah.
Are we sending $61 billion to the military industrial complex, not to Ukraine? Most of the money goes to the U.S. military industrial complex to replenish U.S. stockpiles that have been depleted by sending weapons to Ukraine. Really important to ask again, is the money being spent too late? Not should the money be spent? Should we do something else? Should we try diplomacy? Is the money getting there? Is the aid getting there too late?
Right. Well, that's why, Aaron, that's it's such an urgent question that she has to ask twice, which is why she wasn't able to have the time to say something like, so you're OK with the high civilian death count. You're OK with 34,000 people killed. You want to empower them to continue this. You're OK with children getting amputations without anesthesia. Those are all questions that you could ask, but she had to ask the other question again.
It's important to us. Look at all the good things that have happened to us as a result of this.
Here we go.
Most of the money is being spent in the U.S. in 38 different states. The Europeans have stepped up. We've got two new members of NATO.
That's what it is. Sorry, everybody. Yes, we just love spending money at home because we're all, New Deal Democrats now when it comes to the military-industrial complex. Right. So it's being spent in 38 states, $61 billion. What's not to love? What's the issue? Unfortunately, there's no other way we can spend money at home other than, making more weapons of war.
Through death and killing.
Exactly. So if you care about social programs, then you'll love our social welfare programs for Lockheed Martin and Raytheon.
Right. It's amazing that they say this stuff out loud, but he's not the first one. We've seen other people say this out loud. Jan Stoltenberg from NATO has said that.
It's just incredible. When it comes to like doing anything to help their own citizens, they'll always invoke the free market. You know, government should stay out of the way. Private enterprise, capitalism. They claim to love the free market. As soon as they need to justify, spending more money on a proxy war abroad, they immediately sound like New Deal Democrats. Well, this is creating good jobs. It's being spent at home. It's like they appropriate the same argument that they dismiss for everything else when it can be used to actually help people at home.
Right.
Really shameless.
Shameless. But again, thank you to them for making it clear that this is that we're in the business of war.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, there's all these studies that show that like in terms of, we've never claimed on Useflatus to be, economic experts, but when it comes to, what is a productive use of money for the economy? That the military-industrial complex just is not very efficient in terms of creating it. Even if you forget all the damage it does around the world, just from the metric of like helping the economy, creating jobs, it's a lot more efficient ways to spend your money
than sending
it off to Raytheon.
Right. So you could do two things. You could be efficient and intelligent and wise in your economic decisions, and you could also do that without grinding people to death.
So the Prime Minister of Japan here a couple of weeks ago spent a lot of time talking about Ukraine. And he had previously said, if you want to send President Xi a message, beat Putin in Ukraine.
Okay, there we go. Okay, so that's another benefit of spending $61 billion is we got the Japanese president to talk about Ukraine and say this is good for sending President Xi a message to China. So that's a lot of value right there.
It all goes back to, as our friend Lindsey Graham likes to say, Taiwan.
Taiwan. Yeah. Yeah. Whether a Ukrainian soldier signed up to send a message to President Xi of China, I think it's pretty debatable. I don't know how many Ukrainians care about sacrificing themselves to send a message to China on behalf of Mitch McConnell, but Hey, that's why he's paid the big bucks to come up with plans like this. Okay, more Mitch.
This is a worldwide problem. It's not going to go away after one supplemental.
Well, let's talk about your concerns about the future, the isolationism in your own party. What is your message to the isolationists in the Republican Party?
That Ronald Reagan had it right. You get peace through strength. And I would say to the Democrats, they've got a problem on the left. So it's not just us having kind of an isolationist discussion. You've got visible anti-Semitism on the left. So we've all got to get serious about the challenges ahead of us, engaging in anti-Semitic behavior in the United States needs to be stood up to by the administrators of these colleges.
Well, and we're going to talk about the colleges. Anti-Semitism, though, is not just a problem that's unique to one party or another. I mean, anti-Semitism is something that, the country is facing together. But I do want to...
Tremendous pushback there. Tremendous pushback. Yes, I accept your premise that these kids on college campuses who are opposed to genocide, they're all anti-Semites. Fine. Right. But it's a national problem.
Yeah. So he's basically saying, well, the only isolationists Republicans aren't the only isolationists. There are other anti-Semitic isolationists that come from the Democratic Party. So, right, they're in agreement that the opposition to the war coming from the left, it's not about being anti-genocide. It's about being anti-Jew.
100%. We're going to see many examples of that throughout today's show. Let's hear a little bit more of Mitch McConnell.
Ask you on this issue of the future of the Republican Party, you're saying that it's turned the corner on isolationism. What gives you that confidence when more House Republicans voted against more aid to Ukraine than for it?
All right. So basically, this is like how we conduct an adversarial interview with Mitch McConnell, is saying, like, are you sure that the forces inside your party who oppose more proxy war funding, are you sure that they've been totally stamped out? Because some people were still dissenting from the party line and they were still voting against this money for the military-industrial complex. So how can you be confident that they've been rooted out? That's pretty much adversarial media right now. It's like, it's always, are you sure that there are no more people who might oppose war inside your party? And how do we get them out?
Right.
On both sides.
Right.
Yes.
The anti-Semites on one side and the isolationists on the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very enlightening. Very, very enlightening. Okay. We have more Mitch McConnell. He spoke to...
Sorry about that, guys.
Yeah. He spoke to Face the Nation.
You are leader for another 8 months. But you've said you're going to stay and serve out your term. Donald Trump may again become president. According to our latest CBS polling, 79% of self-identified Republicans told us that the source of information they most trust on Ukraine and Russia is Donald Trump. This sentiment doesn't seem to be disappearing. How are you going to counter that?
What I want to do and what I'm focused on is not the presidential race, but getting the Senate back.
But this isn't the race. This is persuading public opinion.
Yeah, I think the single most important thing I can do is make sure my successor is the majority leader, no matter how the presidential election comes out. I think the fact that our nominee basically decided not to continue whipping people against the package was a good sign. And
see, that's an important point. Mitch McConnell is acknowledging there, which the corporate media doesn't want to do, that actually, after months of scapegoating Trump and saying he was the reason why Republicans were blocking more proxy war funding for Ukraine, and that because Trump is pro-Russian and blah, 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 Trump caved, as he always does, and supported Mike Johnson, House Speaker Mike Johnson, in putting that Ukraine measure on the floor and letting it pass. If you recall, the Republican position from Mike Johnson was that we're not going to pass any money for Ukraine until we secure our border. And by that, they meant like increasing border militarization so it can crack down more on undocumented immigrants. But they dropped that. And they dropped that because basically in Washington, neocons always win. And this posturing that Trump and his allies were doing was just that. It was posturing. They're not fundamentally capable of standing up to the, you know, neocon establishment when it comes to funding wars. And Trump gave his blessing to Mike Johnson to let this Ukraine money pass, which sort of speaks to this fiction about how Republicans are isolationists now. Yeah, they were more hesitant to fund another $61 billion for Ukraine, especially because their own voters were majority against it. But ultimately, like they always do, they caved. And Mitch McConnell is acknowledging Trump obliquely for that, for doing that, for caving.
Right.
And I'm going to be advocating increasing the defense budget, no matter who gets elected, and preparing ourselves for the long term, which is China, Russia, and Iran. This administration budget requests for defense haven't even kept up with inflation.
You said the Republican nominee decided.
All right, so that's very inspiring. Mitch McConnell, he's on his way out. He's retiring as Senate Majority Leader or Senate Minority Leader in the next after the next election. But he's promising us on his way out, and we're done with him now. This is enough of him. That he will keep fighting for more Pentagon spending.
Right, no matter what happens.
Yeah. So Mitch McConnell keeping forward, carrying forward his legacy of enriching the military-industrial complex. He's promising us that.
Right.
With his long political future ahead, because he's got a long way to go, apparently.
It's so funny, though. It's so great that it's called the defense budget instead of, you know, the War Department, which would be a much more honest way of defining it.
Absolutely. Well, yes, everything is a scam. Everything, including the name, including the very names. Okay. Speaking of scams, Lindsey Graham, he still wants to push through the scam of basically getting Saudi Arabia amidst the genocide to agree to normalize with Israel. That's been a long time bipartisan goal. They still think that as Israel is committing mass murder, blocking aid to Gaza, that somehow they can still get that deal done. And the aim of that is to, you know, if Israel and Saudi Arabia normalize, then the Palestinian issue is permanently sidelined, because one of the few things that have been preventing normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel is that there's just so much anger in the Middle East against Israel for its mass murder that Saudi Arabia has felt it can't go ahead and normalize. But yet it's the dream of people like Lindsey Graham to push that through anyway and right. Sideline Palestinians for good. So
here and lots, I mean, there's some debate on this, but lots of people see this as being one of the things that motivated October 7th. The Abraham Accords going through, moving forward.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that one.
Well, that's why I said there's debate about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm not sure where I am in that debate spectrum. Okay. It's a good question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about it. Okay. Anyway, well, let's hear the insights of Lindsey Graham.
Secretary of State Blinken is on his way to Saudi Arabia after he said on Friday that he thinks it is possible to strike a deal to normalize relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, even without a ceasefire in Gaza. You were in Saudi Arabia very recently, last month, and you were pushing for this normalization deal. Is there a deal close at hand, a deal that Prime Minister Netanyahu should accept?
I hope so. So I've been working with Tony and Jake, and I've talked to President Biden twice. I want to help them normalize Saudi Arabia and Israel. Saudi Arabia wants a mutual defense agreement with the United States. We've been working on.
I love how he's on such friendly terms with Antony Blinken and Jake Sullivan.
Yeah, I know.
Tony and Jake.
I know, Tony and Jake. It's great.
Tony and Jake.
It really speaks, again, to the bipartisanship. And that's Jake, Antony Blinken and Jake Sullivan. It really speaks to the bipartisanship of genocide.
Yeah. He's not referring to Jake Tapper or the CNN anchor, although he might as well. They're all part of the same neocon club. But yes, Tony and Jake, his good friends inside the Biden White House.
on this for weeks. To Tony and Jake, get on with closing the deal on the treaty. Without the treaty, MBS cannot recognize Israel. And part of the deal will be coming up with a solution to the Palestinian problem. You know, Saudi Arabia wants a defense agreement with the United States and want to enrich the 7% of the world's uranium they have, but we'll control enrichment and they'll recognize Israel, but we got to deal with the Palestinian problem. We're running out of time. This would be an historic agreement building on the Abraham Accords, and I'd like to see it happen. I'd like to help President Biden get this done. Without this deal, there is no solution to the Palestinian problem. Without this deal, everything gets worse. So let's get the deal done. We're running out of time.
By Palestinian problem, he means the existence of Palestinians. That's what he means.
Right.
And their desire for self-determination. That's a problem. Right. That's a problem for him. That's what is meant by the Palestinian problem. And his solution is let's sideline them by making a side deal with Saudi Arabia that doesn't take their rights into account.
Yeah.
Problem solved. Lindsey Graham's got solutions. He's got friends. He's got Tony and Jake, and he's got solutions. Yeah. So, yes.
And he's like a friend giving support.
Yeah. Have we heard enough of Lindsey Graham? I think we have.
Yeah, probably.
We can keep it moving.
Oh, but I mean, this is even worse from Lindsey Graham to John Kirby. Let's hear what he has to say to George Stephanopoulos.
Joining us again, let's start out with Secretary Blinken's mission. He's going to be in the Middle East tomorrow. What's on the table? What are the prospects for getting that ceasefire and the hostage release?
That's going to be right at the top of the list for Secretary Blinken to keep pushing for this temporary ceasefire. We want it to last for about 6 weeks. It would allow for all those hostages to get out and, of course, to allow for easier aid access to places in Gaza, particularly up in the north. So he's going to be working.
By easier aid access for the people for Gaza, he means Israel's still blocking trucks from going in as they've done from the start, and despite claims from the Biden administration that Israel's not doing that and that they're pressuring Israel, he just means that yes, if finally the hostages, all of them, are released, then finally Israel will stop. He's suggesting Israel will stop blocking so much aid, but which of course there's no guarantee of that. Right. And he's acknowledging tacitly that Israel's deliberately starving the people of Gaza.
Right. Right.
That's what he means, which is mass,
right. Yeah. Mass punishment, yeah. And collective punishment and violation of international law.
But it's just amazing because they won't actually pressure Israel to do anything, including letting in aid trucks. They just have had the same line for more than 6 months. We're doing everything we can. You know, we need to surge aid. It's always prospective. It's always somewhere in the future. It never actually happens because they're letting Israel commit mass starvation and mass murder.
Yeah. Let's hear more
on that. Very, very hard. He'll also be talking to the Israelis about their intentions and their thinking about Rafah military operations and sort of where they are in the planning stages for that.
But if they go into Rafah, ceasefire is off. Any prospect of any short term of short ending to this war is completely over.
Well, look, I think, again, we have to have a better understanding from the Israelis about what they want to do. As a matter of fact, we've had several staff talks with them. We intend to do that more. They've assured us that they won't go into Rafah until we've had a chance to really share our perspectives and our concerns with them.
That's nice. They're going to let America share their concerns, which they will then ignore, as they've done at every stage in this.
Yes. Operation. And also, John Kirby is tacitly acknowledging there that previous U.S. conditions for an Israeli assault on Gaza have been thrown out. The initial line, they were saying for an Israeli operation against Rafah, that Israel needs to have a credible plan to protect civilians.
Civilians, yeah.
Right? That was the condition. That's what we heard for weeks and weeks and weeks. Now John Kirby is saying they've assured us they're not going to go in until they've given us a chance to air our concerns.
Right.
So even their own supposed conditions have been quietly abandoned, which is what they always do, because this has been the line from the start. We're talking to them. We're airing our concerns. Of course, whatever concerns they claim to have shared behind closed doors hasn't deterred Israel from committing mass slaughter repeatedly over and over and over. Right. And for the Biden administration to keep arming them to the teeth and blocking any efforts to have oversight.
But Aaron, it gives them a chance to chat, and that's always important. Communication between friends is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it comes down to. I mean, everything is just a talking point to facilitate mass murder. Everything. Yeah. You know, in the early weeks of the genocide, it was okay, we're gonna send them smaller bombs.
Right.
Because these bombs are too big to drop on urban areas, but they've sent the exact same bombs, these 2,000-pound bombs that are meant for war zones, not urban environments. So everything is a scam. Everything is a scam. And that's John Kirby's job. And somehow the media lets him get away with it. There's very little challenge to him.
Yeah.
And pretty much no challenge to him on these shows.
Right.
So we'll see where that goes. Obviously, George, if we're able to get this hostage deal in place, and we are still working at that, Hamas has not fully rejected it. They are considering this proposal on the table. If we can get that in place, then that gives you 6 weeks of peace. It gives you no fighting for 6 weeks, and that includes no fighting in Rafah. And what we're hoping is that after 6 weeks of a temporary ceasefire, we can maybe get something more enduring in place. We want to see the end of the conflict as soon as possible.
So, give us a pause on the genocide and maybe we'll end it permanently, but we probably won't because we've facilitated it at every stage so far. And that's what they're asking Hamas to accept. Basically, free all the hostages, get 6 weeks of a pause in the genocide, and then Israel's going to resume, no matter what John Kirby suggests to the contrary.
It's really disgusting.
Okay, I think we have more John Kirby, because remember the whole thing with the pier? Biden was going to build a pier off the coast of Gaza to facilitate aid. I don't know. It's taking a while. In the meantime, Gaza civilians have been killed by having airdrops land on them because the U.S. and Israel are still blocking the land crossings. So John Kirby, I guess, will update us on the status of the pier.
The humanitarian crisis is so dire right now. How quickly can this pier get put up, and why is that better than intensifying land operations?
I wouldn't say it's better, George. It's another alternative. It certainly will help increase the volume of aid that's getting into Gaza, but nothing can replace, quite frankly, nothing can replace the ground routes and the trucks that are getting in. And I will say that they have been increasing the amount of trucks that have been getting into Gaza. Now, there's still challenges on the ground and getting it up into the north, but that's starting to happen. And the Israelis have started to meet the commitments that President Biden asked them to meet. This pier is now being constructed. It will take probably 2 to 3 weeks before we can really see it in operation.
You know, there are still protests going on at the land crossings between Israel and Gaza, where people are still out there trying to blockade. And recently, a group of Jewish protesters, including some people from the U.S., so a few of them were on Democracy Now! Today. They were they went there to try to, you know, call for opening up the land crossings. And I believe that they were arrested. So that's what's happening at the land crossings. Israel's blocking them, and Kirby refers obliquely to some challenges. Yeah, like the challenges for starvation, a siege imposed by Israel. That's the challenge, which he's facilitating.
Yeah, they love talking about it like these are inevitable, like red tape issues, just like they like to talk about the starvation as kind of just an inevitable cost of war, as opposed to an intentional policy.
Yeah, yeah. And so people were arrested trying to bring food into Gaza. That's what happened, including two American Jews, Rabbi Alyssa Weiss and the novelist Ayelet Waldman. So that's what's actually happening at the crossings.
The other side, of course, there are people shutting it down.
Yeah, exactly.
Doing everything they can to not let it through. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're not being arrested. They're being encouraged. So people trying to break the blockade. They get arrested. People trying to force the blockade. It's like a party. It's a carnival.
Yeah, it's a carnival. They have Jeremy Lafredo, who's made the video for the Gray Zone, right? He is a great video. I had him on the Katie Helper show, and you can see there's literally cotton candy being spun at the border so that it's a fun time for kids. It's a fun time for all to block humanitarian aid. Sick society, everyone.
Okay, so Hannah Siegel is the niece of Keith Siegel, who is one of the people being held captive, and she spoke to Face the Nation.
Of And you have 205 there. That's the number of days he has been held. In the video, your uncle, under duress, mentions the protests that have been taking place in Israel, pressuring the government for a deal. Do you think that a deal can be reached at this point, and is it up to the United States to close it?
I do think a deal can be reached. I mean, we know that. A deal was reached in November. Dozens of women and children were released, including my aunt, Aviva Siegel. So we know that it's possible, and I do think that's really important to remember. The United States plays a critical role. It played a critical role in November. I think, you know, ultimately, this is a negotiation between Hamas and Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. And one of the things that really worries my family and worries me is that it's arguably not in Prime Minister Netanyahu's political interest to close a deal. And, you know, for us, this is the moment. These videos, as you know, there was a video released a couple of days ago of another American hostage, Hirsch Goldberg-Polen. Mm-hmm. I do think that these two videos are a signal from Hamas that they are ready to make a deal and a reminder that there are American citizens being held, including Keith.
There are 133.
So, you know, there's an acknowledgement that it's in Netanyahu's interest to prolong this mass murder campaign and to jeopardize the lives of the remaining captives accordingly. You know, there was I believe a former spokesperson for the hostages' families recently said that they all could have been released early on had Netanyahu accepted a deal. And he blamed Netanyahu for what's currently going on, if I have that right.
Yeah, it was a clip with a journalist and former negotiator named Gershon Baskin. We have the clip if we want to watch it. It's fairly short. Texted it to Wilson. No,
okay. Okay, we can keep moving more Mitch. Well, let's talk about what's happening on campus.
Oh yeah, but that's just really important. By the way, let's just remind people that Netanyahu has killed more hostages than he saved. And if we cared, if they cared about this, and all the people who say bring them home now, it's so interesting that they never get mad at Netanyahu for blocking these negotiations.
Well, here's who we should get mad at: is young people putting their bodies on the line at campuses across the country to oppose mass murder, because they are really drawing the ire of everybody, of Republicans, Democrats. Joe Biden's called them anti-Semites. Mitch McConnell has called them anti-Semites. Netanyahu made a video basically calling for them to be censored, which is, an Israeli leader telling the U.S. what to do with its own free speech and its own campuses is pretty extraordinary. But that speaks to the Israeli entitlement that they feel as a U.S. client. So Mitch McConnell has thoughts on the wave of protests and encampments across the country.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the tensions in the Middle East that have spilled over across this country. As you referenced, we have seen pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses all across the country. House Speaker Mike Johnson was at Columbia University this week. He said, quote, "This is dangerous. This is not the First Amendment. This is not free expression." Do you agree with him? Is that your assessment, too?
I think it's a dangerous situation. You said pro-Palestinian. There's also anti-Semitism, which is completely unacceptable. I've been shocked to see that in this country. First responsibility is the administrations of these colleges. That's the first responsibility. And so the speaker is correct in laying the blame on the administrators. When I was in college, and I bet when you were in college, there were plenty of debates, but we were not trying to shut people up and had aggressive civil discussions. That's
who's trying to shut who up here? Netanyahu's the one who just came out and said these people should be censored.
Right.
That's what Republicans are calling for, too. So who's being civil and who's not? These people have set up encampments on university campuses. I've been to one. I went to the one at UCLA. Okay, you've been outside the one at Columbia.
And I went to the one at City College.
At CUNY as well. These are really impressive young people trying to oppose a genocide.
Yeah.
And they're extremely peaceful.
Yeah.
And it's if you look at the video footage that's come out of Zionist counter protesters, they're insane.
Yeah.
I just saw one, you know, this is very common now with pro-Israel protesters, is wishing rape upon their, you know, Palestinian supporters. They're always talking about you should get raped. I mean, there's so many videos like this. Somebody even at one campus was yelling, kill the Jews. It turned out to be a pro-Israel supporter.
Right. And pro-Palestine support protesters were arrested, even though this was a pro-Israel supporter saying that. Kill the Jews. So that's, yeah. And also, you know, as I've said before, these encampments are so anti-Semitic that Jews were holding Shabbat Sabbath services and holding Seders in these encampments.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, honestly, even if there wasn't a single Jewish person at these encampments and there weren't Jewish, you know, services and rituals going on, even if there were, but which of course there are, because there's so many Jewish kids who are opposed to genocide.
Right.
Even if there weren't, even if for some reason you couldn't find one Jewish college student, even then the claim of anti-Semitism would be just as ridiculous.
Right. It just makes it one level higher of ridiculous.
No, I know. Yeah. But I'm just saying it's just such a cheap use.
Of
the legacy of anti-Semitism, and they do it freely, and it's just, you know, we're Jewish, so it's particularly sensitive to see the legacy of it being weaponized in such a disgusting way. But they get away with it because no one challenges it.
Yeah.
It's very hard to challenge it inside the establishment.
It is, yeah. But he's going to make a really good point right now. Ready?
The responsibility of the college administrators. And to do anything else makes them look like they're sympathetic with one side or the other. And I think restoring order and civility to have reasonable debates is what needs to happen.
To the students who are protesting peacefully, though, do they have a right to protest on college campuses?
By the way, all of the students are protesting peacefully.
Exactly.
It's making it sound like to that subsection of students protesting peacefully, the only people who have engaged in violence have been the police.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, of course. Yeah, but I think people need to understand just the fact that we have the First Amendment doesn't give you the right to scream fire in a theater and run everybody out. I mean, sure, you're free to speak, but you're not free to harm others with your speech.
I want to talk to you about abortion.
Okay, what are they yelling that's the equivalent of fire?
He can't point to it. And what he's being is he's being a identitarian snowflake. You know, it's conservatives who have made fun of liberals for, you know, saying that there's limits on free speech and you can't harm someone with your speech. And what he means by harm in this case is calling out a genocide, calling out Zionism, that's harm. That's not protected speech.
Right.
That's, you know, and he wants to crack down on that. He's being a snowflake. He's being exactly what so many conservatives make fun of liberals and college students for supposedly doing.
They don't want anyone to feel uncomfortable.
Exactly.
And they're pretending that's harm.
They're the most extreme identitarians in the country.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are criticisms to make or, you know, just a fair point you can make about sometimes about, you know, safetyism and the extent to which people's police can be the extent to which speech can be policed on the liberal, you know, side. But this is the Republicans and supporters of Israel are extremely just beyond the pale in trying to police speech and trying to stop people from making genocide supporters feel, quote, unsafe.
Right. And this is an important point, I think, from Jonathan Conklin, which is if there is a fire, then it is legal to yell fire. So these people are yelling that there's genocide and there is genocide. But of course, that parallel doesn't work anyway, because it's not doesn't cause stampedes.
Yeah, no, they're inside encampments on their own university, protesting peacefully.
Yeah,
they're not, you know, and again, it's Zionist groups that are attacking them, and there are infiltrators pretending to be Palestinian supporters, who are, you know, doing really really terrible jobs of trying to frame people as being as violent and supporting violence when you know,
and we're just lucky enough that with that last case of someone saying death to Jews. Or kill the Jews, were lucky enough that a journalist that was at Northeastern in Boston, but luckily a journalist was there and could say that was a pro-Israel protester. But think about how many times someone will do that without being exposed.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And also there was a, he's actually a boxer. I think his name is David or Daniel Kaminsky. He's a boxer and has a boxing studio in Los Angeles. And he was at a protest in LA the other day and spat at a protester and called him a bitch ass N-word. And I'm waiting to hear him be condemned by the media. And also, you know, speaking about Jeremy Lofredo again, he had a video from early on at a protest in New York City where people were saying, kill all Palestinians, kill them all, not one left, Palestine, my D-I-C-K. And you didn't hear the media talking about that on civil speech, those that hate speech, racist hate speech.
No.
It's almost like there's a double standard.
Okay, so Facing Nation did a recap of some of the protests happening at college campuses.
Our Mark Strassman reports on those college campus protests that have erupted across the country.
All the clamor on campus keeps spreading. A clash of more than ideas. Riot gear at Ohio State. Tasers at Emory University in Atlanta. Mostly pro-Palestinian protesters, at times scuffling with police, waved on by school administrators.
Scuffling with police. That's an interesting way to describe police brutality. Like a dance. Like it takes two to tango. No, there are people who've been knocked on the ground. I mean, there's footage of older professors knocked on the ground. Not that it's okay to brutalize younger protesters, but it just, I mean, all this talk of decorum and civility, they don't even respect elders. They just drag them onto the ground, bang them onto the concrete. But it's called scuff. But this is presented as like a clash between protesters and cops, as opposed to an assault by cops.
Hundreds of arrests. Communities like the University of Texas turning on each other.
Oh, by the way, there have been campuses where there were snipers on the top of buildings.
Mm-hmm. In Indiana, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Texas turning on each other. Israel's war.
And it's also intentional, by the way, that they haven't shown. I mean, they showed some police dragging, but they didn't show the most shocking stuff that you'd think that they would be interested in showing. Like professors being dragged onto the, pushed onto the ground. Jill Stein was also thrown to the ground.
War on Hamas has another front line.
Again, Israel's war on Hamas, which is a lie, but just another example of how the propaganda is slid in there, right? It's a war by Israel on Hamas as opposed to obviously a war on the people of Palestine.
A free speech and hate speech campus debate that's anything but academic.
If you want to protect free speech, then you don't break up peaceful protests.
People didn't seem to be aware of how bad the situation for free speech and academic freedom already was on campus until October 7th.
Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a group defending the right to free speech.
Do you have the sense that any of this is moving the ball forward?
Some of the ways the protest has been going on college campuses has been alienating more of the public than bringing it in.
Okay, why is a free speech expert giving advice on protest tactics? What is that his area of expertise? Why does he care about that? Why do we care about what he has to say about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. FIRE, I believe, is kind of conservative.
Yeah, they are.
So that's probably why.
Yeah, of course it is. But it's just like you're supposed to be talking about free speech and you're being asked about whether or not these are good PR moves. But again, because they can't, they have to sneak in as much criticism undermining as they can of these protests.
It's a little suspicious. Like, he's like, I'm supposed to be here to talk about free speech, but instead I'm going to weigh in on these alienating protests. Yeah. They're pretty alienating.
Yeah.
I wish I could talk about the right to free speech, but I got to say, I'm pretty alienated by these displays of young people sleeping in tents to protest mass murder paid for by their tax dollars.
Yeah, and also the whole point is that free speech allows things that you may not be comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they have to delegitimize these protests. It's pathetic. That question and answer was pathetic.
A very unfiery defense of free speech from fire.
Right. Okay. But don't worry, there's even more.
Columbia University's West Lawn, civil disobedience, this ongoing tent city, galvanized national protests. They want the university to divest investments in Israel and companies they say profit off repression of Palestinians. Dueling protests at Columbia, pro-Israel, pro-Palestinian, reflect a larger welter of opinion and emotion, passion, and perceived prejudice.
People would be up in arms and protesting that right away. But because it's the Jews, I feel like nobody cares.
All this.
Okay, what is that comment even? They love making this point. People love making this point, like, that if there were hate speech against Black people, who made that point this week? Who was it? We released it, I think, on Thursday Throwdown.
NYU professor Scott Galloway.
Oh, Scott Galloway, yeah.
Yes.
You know, if there were racism against calls for lynching and anti-gay speech, people care, but because it's anti-Jewish speech, which, again, you are conflating anti-Zionism, criticism of Israel, with anti-Semitism, which is based on an anti-Semitic trope that states that all Jews are a monolith who blindly support Israel. But thanks for giving that woman the chance to make a totally incoherent point.
This coast-to-coast commotion is well into its second week, and what began here at Columbia has now rippled overseas.
From Paris to London, university students occupied buildings and marched in the streets. They're echoing this U.S. student movement. At times, a moment that's been unflattering, even dark, from intolerant protesters to stumbling universities.
Intolerant protesters?
Unflattering? What's he talking about?
Yeah.
Unflattering.
Well, don't worry, guys. We're going to hear more from Fire, Mr. Fire.
The campuses are teaching young people to think like activists and less like scholars. When you're reduced to just shouting at each other, that is a failure of some of the things that makes higher education so special.
Okay, thanks again for weighing in on something totally not in your wheelhouse, which is free speech. Why on earth would you be telling us about your opinions on education? And again, is he coming in as like an organizer with tips on how to reach people? It's just so absurd. Like, this is the guy they have on for free speech, and most of the stuff that he's saying is not defending free speech.
And he's resorting to the familiar tactic where you don't want to take a moral position on a pretty clear moral issue, in this case, mass murder. You want to turn this into a civility thing. Like, why can't we all talk to each other, yelling, screaming both sides, and you know, drawing parity between two sides, the side opposing mass murder and the side that supports mass murder.
Right.
That's a way to actually taking a moral position on how you feel about, you know, slaughtering tens of thousands of people inside Gaza. That's what it comes down to. But he can't outright take a position because he has to pose as a free speech champion, which is clearly not.
Who spends most of his time not criticizing speech.
All right. Well, keeping in the vein of some snitch journalism, just like corporate media voices trying to smear these young people protesting genocide. Here is Dana Bash of CNN, longtime launderer of Israeli propaganda. Here she is trying to basically get Bernie Sanders to denounce these college protesters. And watch how she does it.
I want to ask you a little bit more about these protests that are going on here in the United States. And listen to one of the leaders of the Columbia protests.
Zionists, they don't deserve to live comfortably, let alone Zionists don't deserve to live.
Now, I want to be clear, that protester was just banned from campus. But it isn't an isolated incident. Some Jewish students say they face threats.
That's a disgusting and stupid.
Why is not it's not an isolated incident? Some students say they've received threats. Has she shown any of that? Has she asked anyone about the man spitting on protesters and calling them bitch ass N-words? Or has she asked anyone about the kill the Jews coming from pro-Israel people?
So what they're doing is taking one incendiary clip, not even filmed at the protest at Columbia, and And again, and she's also, by the way, conflating Zionists with Jews. And of course, right. everyone has the right to live. But, you know, I'd love to hear more from the student what they meant by that comment. But what I'm imagining they're saying is, you know, insofar as Zionism means privileging the rights of Israeli Jews over indigenous Palestinians and committing mass murder to impose that supremacy, he's saying that they've lost their right to security, which is, you know, like, again, I wouldn't frame it like that. And I think everyone has the right to live. But the point is, the converse argument, which is that Palestinians have no right to live, have no right to freedom, have no right to basic dignity, have no right to life. That's Dana Bash's argument every single day in support right. of Israeli mass murder. So that's like, you know, the soapbox here is very, very silly.
Yeah. She, course, I mean, yeah. I think that was very stupid to say. Obviously, I kind of agree with what Bernie's about to say. But my point is that why do they pick out people on one side and not the other?
Yeah. Yeah. And one person, when the entire mainstream is constantly saying, is defending policies that exterminate Palestinians.
Right. Exactly.
As opposed to a powerless college student.
Yeah.
Making one line.
Also, this is important. Thomas Richardson points out that clip is literally evidence that the university was taking disciplinary action against that student.
There you go. Well, Dana Bash, it's not enough. Bernie Sanders needs to throw the whole movement under the bus because
right,
of it.
Based on one statement.
Yeah.
But it's not isolated.
That is a disgusting and stupid remark. It's not isolated. But you have, Donald, let's take a deep look about beyond the protests. How do the American people feel about U.S. military aid to the Netanyahu government?
But that's poll not about. But that's not about military shows, aid. That's about Jews.
No, first of all, it's not about Jews. As you said, look, and I think those are stupid comments, but as you just said, Aaron, they're about Zionists. Dana is projecting her own Zionism onto other Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't like that. We Jews who don't support what Israel's doing, can you take our name out of your mouth, Dana? Thanks.
What this guy said was disgusting, period. And I would hope that every American condemns anti-Semitic discussion. But what I am talking about right now is, you know, what Netanyahu is trying to do very clearly is to say, anybody who criticizes what Israel is doing, you are anti-Semitic. Well, are there some anti-Semites? Well, you just saw one. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, if you look at the polling, the vast majority of the American...
Sorry, Bernie, I'm not going to call that kid an anti-Semite.
Right.
He's someone who is opposed to Jewish supremacy and Zionism, which is different than Judaism.
Right.
And I mean, you can criticize his comment, you know, calling people's death, fair enough.
Right. But that doesn't make him an anti-Semite.
He's not an anti-Semite.
Right.
He's not.
And again, most Zionists in the world and in the country are Christian.
People are disgusted with Netanyahu's war machine in Gaza, and they do not want further U.S. military aid to his government.
You know, I've gotten texts from students, one in Michigan in particular, who said that he has to take his Jewish star off because people aren't asking him about his view on Israel, which is might be just like yours, but they're just looking at his Jewish star and they're attacking him because he's Jewish. So how do you?
Oh my God! You know, there are Jews at these protests right. across the country. There's that video of like that one lady who wears like a t-shirt saying Jew and she goes.
Oh, yeah, that's great. We covered that on Thursday Throwdown. Nobody yeah, literally cares. No one cares. Yeah.
So this is the easiest thing in the world. Everyone can do this. You know, like I could say right now with a lot more accuracy, my friend in hijab texted me and said yeah. that, you know, she's afraid to wear it. But, you know, it's like, I mean, but that would actually be accurate if you look at the way these right. Zionist protesters, counter protesters behave. I'm sorry, I just don't buy it. And if so, where are the cases of actual hate crimes against right. Jews? You know, like where is it?
Also, if that's even true that she got that text, if she had any friends who were Palestinian, she'd get texts like you were saying, Aaron, about being afraid to wear a hijab or keffiyeh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And by the way, you know, there have been cases where people, it's so obvious that they're Zionists, wrapping themselves in keffiyehs, shouting incendiary things. When it's so obvious if you listen to their voices that they're Jewish people. Like Max Blumenthal and I covered one last week. There's one where these two guys are saying, like, never forget the 7th of October. There's going to be so many more 7th. You know, it's like, it's so obvious. And like, you can't see any part of their face. It's so obvious that they're just dressing up. So that's what people are doing. But anyway, let's hear more, Bernie.
Let me say that for the third time. All right. I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. All right. My father's family was wiped out by Hitler. Anti-Semitism is a disgusting and vile form of bigotry which has killed millions of people. Mm-hmm. I would hope that every American condemns anti-Semitism. We condemn Islamophobia and all forms of bigotry.
All right.
Okay.
That's fair. Let's go to the next next Bernie clip. There's more.
Here with me is independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Thank you so much for being here, sir. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said this week that college protests in the U.S. are being led by, quote, anti-Semitic mobs. You responded by accusing him of, quote, attempting to distract us from the immoral and illegal war policies of your extremist and racist government. And you said, quote, it is not anti-Semitic to hold you accountable for your actions. Senator, can't both things be true? There are legitimate criticisms of the Netanyahu government, but some of these protests have also clearly tapped into a deep undercurrent of anti-Semitism.
Does she have any evidence for that?
God.
How about some of the media coverage has tapped into a deep undercurrent of Islamophobia and Jewish supremacy?
Like, everything is always like, okay, yes. Here's what's happening in front of us. You have Jews at these protests, you know, joining Palestinians and their supporters to oppose genocide. But isn't there underneath all that, like below ground? We can't see it. Right. It's there. It's deep.
You can feel it.
It's undercurrent, you know? They could just come up with anything they want to justify their narrative.
Yeah, without any proof.
Yeah.
Look, Dana, anti-Semitism is a vile and disgusting ideology which has resulted in the deaths of many, many millions of people in the last 100 years. And we've got to oppose it in every form. And do I doubt for a moment that anti-Semitism exists and is growing in the United States, that is part, that exists among some people in the protest movement? Of course. But here is the reality.
Again, why even say that? I'm sorry. No, there's no need to cater to this cheap weaponization of anti-Semitism, which is aimed to silence people who oppose genocide. I'm tired of hearing about anti-Semitism at a time when the state acting in the name of the Jewish people is committing mass murder. It's such a, first of all, I don't see any evidence for it. Of course, in any place where there's human beings, you're going to have people who have hate. You're going to have anti-Semites. But the idea that it's somehow like a part of the pro-Palestine movement is just, there's no evidence for that whatsoever. Yeah. It's people who oppose mass murder. You don't have to apologize for that or cater to the talking points of people who support mass murder. You just don't. It's disappointing from Bernie. I understand he's in a tough position because he faces.
I think it may be good strategically, honestly, in terms of reaching.
I don't think it's good strategically because why cater to the talking points of disingenuous people? I don't see how that benefits anybody. I understand the need to, for example, throwing that, condemning that Columbia protester who said the thing about killings. Okay, fair enough. But I'm sorry, like this, anyway.
I just think it's more effective for reaching people who aren't already with us. I'm sure there are a lot of people who will get mad at me for saying this, but I wouldn't spend time on it. But I understand Bernie spending time on it. And this isn't because I'm incapable of criticizing Bernie. I just think that it may be useful. Yeah, okay. Oops.
Right now, what Netanyahu's right-wing extremist and racist government is doing is unprecedented in the modern history of warfare. They have killed in the last 6.5 months 33,000 Palestinians, wounded 77,000, two-thirds of whom are women and children. They have destroyed over 60% of the housing. They have destroyed the healthcare system. They have destroyed the infrastructure. No electricity, very little water. And right now, we are looking at the possibility of mass starvation and famine in Gaza. When you make those charges, that is not anti-Semitic. That is a reality. So our job is to condemn Hamas, a terrorist organization that started this war, condemn in every form anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and other forms of bigotry. But we do have to pay attention to the disastrous and unprecedented humanitarian disaster taking place in Gaza right now.
Yeah, so Bernie, you know, again, I appreciate his efforts. He's one of the rare few who are actually criticizing Israel, and he deserves credit for that. But I'm sorry, he caters too much to his early talking points. Hamas didn't start the war. You can criticize Hamas and saying, you can say October 7th was, you know, they killed civilians and that's wrong and it was criminally stupid for Hamas to do that. But to say they started it, that erases the entire history of this whole issue, which is that on October 7th, Gaza was under military occupation, the longest running military occupation in the world, which also began with ethnic cleansing. That's what started this whole thing. Right.
Also, this is my fault. I changed the order by accident of those clips. They should have been in the opposite order, but it's so telling that Bernie comes on, talks about Israel's crimes against humanity, and then Dana pivots back to, let's talk about the anti-Semitism at protests. That's what's important to Dana.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so are we going to actually hear a... Should we skip the shout out to Summer Lee for making a good point, which is that anti-Semitism is not anti-Zionism, but should we skip to a more infuriating clip?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Should we go to Fareed? Which one do you want?
Well, we're running out of time, so.
Or should we go White House correspondence?
I think we should acknowledge the White House correspondence.
Okay, yeah.
So our fearless press corps gathered for their yearly gala celebrating just what a free country we have and how journalists are doing their job and holding the power to account by partying with the powerful. Yeah.
And by the way, sorry, keep going. Sorry.
No, my bad.
Well, I was going to say part of the failure of the media is that, and I just saw a comment on this, someone saying no talk about the mass graves. That's also relevant, which is that none of these morning shows talked about the discovery of mass graves with people who were handcuffed and shot in the head and neck, because they have to talk about the real hate crimes, which is saying stuff critical of Zionism.
I'm sorry. You know, Dana Bash got a text from a Jewish student who
at Michigan.
So we got to talk about that. We got to talk about that text, not the mass graves.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so on that note of media malpractice, let's take a look at what they... We want to take a look at what they said about freedom of the press and war on journalism.
At the Wall Street Journal, they are counting. For Moscow correspondent Evan Gerskovich, 396 days since he was jailed in Russia. The U.S. government has designated Evan as wrongfully detained. And Evan's parents and his family are with us tonight, and we are with you always. We remember Austin Tice, 4,276 days, nearly 12 years since he was kidnapped in Syria. His mother, Deborah, is with us. And Mrs. Tice, we are with you. And Mr. President, again, we humbly ask that you do everything you can to bring them home. Our profession can be perilous. Since October, about 100 journalists have been killed, most of those deaths in Gaza, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Around the world, more than 320 reporters imprisoned as of December, including an American with...
Well, they mentioned the Palestinian journalists.
I know. I couldn't believe it.
I mean, they didn't say who killed them. It just seems like relevant info. Like, who killed all these journalist colleagues of ours?
And targeted them.
Yeah.
Knowing where they lived and killing them and their families.
Yeah.
And who is funding them.
Yeah. I mean, especially in journalism.
That part out.
In journalism, you know, the whole thing is, it's important to deliver facts.
right,
and to name names. And unfortunately, that wasn't done there by this journalist. But right, at least they, I mean, it's, you know, or I'm surprised.
Follow the
money. I'm surprised they acknowledged the murders of.
At all.
Yeah, of Palestinian journalists in Gaza.
Right. Right.
Okay. Well, listen. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that she's calling on Biden to do everything he can to free these journalists who are held in other countries. It's interesting that, you know, who they could have invited to that White House press dinner would have been Stella Assange and Julian Assange, his kids, another journalist who's locked up. But of course, they wouldn't have done that because that is locked up. He's locked up by Biden. And then she could have said, Biden, do everything you can, which literally is a phone call to the Justice Department to stop persecuting and imprisoning Julian Assange. But instead, he's pursuing Assange.
Okay. Should we do the last clip? I mean, it's so cringe, but
yeah,
let's do it. So the MC of the night, or the like the featured comedian, was Colin Jost of SNL, who gave a touching tribute to President Biden.
And decency.
And with my family in mind, I wanted to share one last thing with you before I go. And I wanted to share one thing with you, Mr. President, before I go. I lost my grandfather this year, as you alluded to, a firefighter, William Kelly. He's the reason that our son's middle name is William.
So I couldn't help but think about, you know, by the way, this last week, Rafat Alarears, the killed poet and translator and professor, who was targeted and killed with his sister and some of her relatives when Israel targeted the sister's apartment, not the building. They just targeted the apartment. He lost his daughter and grandson this week. And it's nice that Colin Jost, I'm not happy his grandfather died, but it's nice that his grandfather died not by being buried alive or bombed.
He helped raise me growing up, and I would not be here today without him. My grandpa was a firefighter on Staten Island for 40 years to make extra money for his family.
All right, sorry, I don't care about his grandfather. Let's just skip to his, you know, kissing the feet of Joe Biden, and then we can get out of here.
You made fun of him running upstairs there.
I think
that's the extent to adversarial comedy, is you make fun of the president for falling up the stairs.
I think it's because he didn't try to run up them. The other 30% was for Giuliani. So we're not always on the right side of history, Mr. President.
There we go.
My grandfather, a Staten Island firefighter, voted for you, Mr. President. He voted for you in the last election that he ever voted in. I mean, I'm sure someone else will vote twice in this election using his name, but that's just how the Democratic machine works. He voted for you, and the reason that he voted for you is because you're a decent man. My grandpa voted for decency, and decency is why we're all here tonight. Decency is how we're able to be here tonight. Decency is how we're able to make jokes about each other and one of us doesn't go to prison after. We go to the Newsmax after party.
Okay, so joke, you know, so yes, we're so decent that, you know, journalists aren't jailed except for Julian Assange, who remains in prison for the crime of exposing U.S. state crimes. That's what Julian Assange did, and he's still being locked up, pursued by Biden, prosecuted by Biden, for that he wants to extradite him. And then again, decency. I mean, I don't know how many people are in that room, say like 2,000. So multiply that by 15 and you still don't have the amount of people who Joe Biden has helped kill in Gaza with U.S. made bombs. So that's the decent guy. Anyway, that, you know, it, yeah. How you can call yourself a journalist and go to that thing, to be on me. And by the way, okay, someone who did go to that dinner, of course, was the brave Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, and she was roughed up by security there and suffered some injuries. So I hope Medea is recovering from that, and as always, you know, grateful to Code Pink and everybody who protested outside. There was an amazing scene outside that dinner of people protesting and, you know, call, even a Palestinian flag was unfurled from the hotel. So the commitment of people in the streets, despite all the efforts against them being demonized, being assaulted by police officers, inspired, you know, this really began with the brave people of these college protests across the country. It's really inspiring.
Yeah,
I'm very grateful for it.
I'm having
That's the decency we're seeing right now in this country.
Right.
That's
people decency. Protesting it. Yeah. Yeah. I'm interviewing Medea tomorrow on my show, on the Katie Halper show.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a great place to end Monday morning. Another, depressing episode, but hopefully we made you laugh a little bit.
Yeah.
And,
And we will see you next week. Thanks, everyone.